Rhaeshyfir, the Midnight Mother, giving birth to abominations with her essence so dark, so terrible, so consuming. She is here! She watches me die!
Dated Shashabev, 1173, 8 seconds pre-death. Subject, a dark-eyed dock worker in his 40s, father of three.
I have a serious loathing of being wrong.
Adolin reclined in his chair, one hand resting leisurely on the crystal-topped table, the other swirling wine in his cup, yellow wine. He wasn't on duty today, so he could indulge just a tad. Wind ruffled his hair. He was sitting with a group of other young light eyes at the outdoor tables of an outer market wine shop. The outer market was a collection of buildings that had grown up near the king's palace, outside the war camps. An eclectic mix of people passed on the street below their terraced seating.
I should think that everyone shares your dislike, Gadolin.
Yakimov leaned with both elbows on the table. He was a sturdy man, a light eyes of the Third Dawn, from High Prince Royan's camp.
Who likes being wrong?
I've known a number of people who prefer it. Of course, they don't admit that fact. But what else could one presume from the frequency of their error?
Nkima, Yakimov's accompaniment for the afternoon, was a plump thing with light yellow eyes who dyed her hair black. She wore a red dress. The color did not look good on her. Danlin was also there, of course. She sat on a chair beside Adolin, keeping proper distance, though she'd occasionally touch his arm with her free hand. Her wine was violet. She did like her wine, though she seemed to match it to her outfits.
Curious trait.
Adolin smiled. She looked extremely fetching, with that long neck and graceful build, wrapped in a sleek dress. She didn't dye her hair, though it was mostly auburn.
There's nothing wrong with light hair. In fact, why is it that you're all so fond of dark hair when light eyes are the ideal? Stop it. I'll end up brooding as much as father.
The other two, Toril and his companion Eshava, were both light eyes from High Prince Aladar's camp. House Colin was currently out of favor, but Adolin had acquaintances of friends in nearly all of the war camps.
Wrongness can be amusing. It keeps life interesting. If we were all right all the time, where would that leave us?
My dear, didn't you once claim to me that you were nearly always right?
Yes. And so if everyone were like me, who would I make sport of? I dread being made so mundane by everyone else's competence.
Adolin smiled, taking a drink of his wine. He had a formal duel in the arena today, and he'd found that a cup of yellow beforehand helped him relax.
Well, you needn't worry about me being right too often. I was sure Satius would move against my father. Doesn't make sense. Why wouldn't he?
Positioning, perhaps?
Toril was a keen fellow, known for his refined sense of taste. Adolin always wanted him along when trying wines.
He wants to look strong.
He is strong. He gains no more by not moving against us.
Now, I know that I'm quite new to the war camps, and my assessment is bound to reflect my ignorance, but...
You always say that, you know.
I always say what?
That you're ignorant. However, you're anything but. You're among the most clever women I've met.
She hesitated, looking oddly annoyed for a moment. Then she smiled.
You shouldn't say such things, Adolin, when a woman is attempting humility.
Oh, right, humility. I've forgotten that existed.
Too much time around Satius's light eyes?
Anyway, I'm sorry. Please continue.
I was saying that I doubt Satius would wish to start a war. Moving against your father in such an obvious way would have done that, wouldn't it?
Undoubtedly.
So perhaps that is why he held himself back.
I don't know. He could have cast shame on your family without attacking you. He could have implied, for instance, that you'd been negligent and foolish in not protecting the king, but that you hadn't been behind the assassination attempt.
That still could have started a war.
Perhaps. But you have to admit, Adolin, that the Blackthorn's reputation is a little less than impressive of late.
And what does that mean?
Oh, Adolin, don't be so tiresome. You know what I'm saying, and you also know I mean no insult by it. Oh, where's that serving woman?
One would think that after 6 years out here, we would get a decent wine house.
My father's reputation is sound. Or have you not been paying attention to our victories lately?
Achieved with Sadius's help.
Achieved nonetheless. In the last few months, my father saved not only Sadius's life, but that of the king himself. He fights boldly. Surely you can see that previous rumors about him were absolutely unfounded.
All right, all right. No need to get upset, Adolin. We can all agree that your father is a wonderful man, but you were the one who complained to us that you wanted to change him.
Adolin studied his wine. Both of the other men at the table wore the sort of outfits Adolin's father frowned upon. Short jackets over colorful silk shirts. Toril wore a thin yellow silk scarf at the neck and another around his right wrist. It was quite fashionable and looked far more comfortable than Adolin's uniform. Dalinar would have said that the outfits looked silly, but sometimes fashion was silly. Bold, different. There was something invigorating about dressing in a way that interested others, moving with the waves of style. Once, before joining his father at the war, Adolin had loved being able to design a look to match a given day. Now, he had only two options, summer uniform coat or winter uniform coat. The serving maid finally arrived, bringing two carafes of wine, one yellow and one deep blue. Adolin held up a hand to forestall the maid from filling his cup.
I'm not sure I want to see my father change. Not anymore.
Last week...
I know. That was before I saw him rescue Sadius. Every time I start to forget how amazing my father is. He does something to prove me one of the 10 fools. It happened when Elikar was in danger too. It's like... my father only acts like that when he really cares about something.
You imply that he doesn't really care about the war, Adolin, dear.
No, just that the lives of Elikar and Sadius might be more important than killing Parshendi.
The others took that for an explanation, moving on toward other topics. But Adolin found himself circling the thought. He felt unsettled lately. Being wrong about Sadius was one cause. The chance that they might actually be able to prove the visions right or wrong was another. Adolin felt trapped. He'd pushed his father to confront his own sanity, and now, by what their last conversation had established, he had all but agreed to accept his father's decision to step down if the visions proved false.
Everyone hates being wrong. Except my father said he'd rather be wrong if it would be better for Alethkar.
Adolin doubted many light eyes would rather be proven mad than right.
Perhaps, but that doesn't change all of his foolish restrictions. I wish he would step down.
What? What was that?
Nothing. Just seeing if you were attending the conversation, Adolin.
No, tell me what you were saying.
Esheva shrugged, looking at Toril. Toril leaned forward.
You don't think the war camps are ignoring what happens to your father during high storms, Adolin? Word is that he should abdicate because of it.
That would be foolish, considering how much success he's showing in battle.
Stepping down would be far too much of an overreaction. Though, Adolin, I do wish you could get your father to relax all of these foolish restrictions our camp is under. You and the other Colin men would be able to truly join society again.
I've tried, trust me. And, unfortunately, I have a duel to prepare for, if you'll excuse me.
Some more of Sadius's sycophants?
No, it's Bright Lord Ressi. There have been some vocal provocations from Thanadol, and this might serve to shut his mouth.
I'll meet you there.
Thanks.
Adolin rose, doing up the buttons on his coat. He trotted out onto the street.
That was something of an abrupt departure for me. Will they see how uncomfortable the discussion made me? Probably not.
They didn't know him as Renarin did. Adolin liked to be familiar with a large number of people, but not terribly close with any of them. He didn't even know Danlin that well yet. He would make his relationship with her last, though. He was tired of Renarin teasing him for jumping in and out of courtships. Danlin was very pretty. It seemed the courtship could work. He passed through the outer market, Toril's words weighing on him. Adolin didn't want to become High Prince. He wasn't ready. He liked dueling and chatting with his friends. Leading the army was one thing, but as High Prince, he'd have to think of other things. such as the future of the war on the Shattered Plains, or protecting and advising the king.
That shouldn't have to be our problem.
But it was as his father always said.
If we don't do it, who will?
The outer market was far more disorganized than the markets inside Dalinar's war camp. Here, the ramshackle buildings, mostly built of stone blocks quarried from nearby, had grown up without any specific plan. A large number of the merchants were Thalen, with their typical caps, vests, and long wagging eyebrows. The busy market was one of the few places where soldiers from all 10 war camps mingled. In fact, that had become one of the main functions of the place. It was neutral ground where men and women from different war camps could meet. It also provided a market that wasn't heavily regulated, though Dalinar had stepped in to provide some rules once the marketplace had begun to show signs of lawlessness. Adolin nodded to a passing group of Kolin soldiers in blue who saluted him. They were on patrol, halberds held at their shoulders, helms gleaming. Dalinar's troops patrolled this place, and his scribes watched over it, all at his own cost. His father didn't like the layout of the outer market or its lack of walls. He said that a raid could be catastrophic to it, that it violated the spirit of the codes.
But it's been years since the Parshendi have raided the Alethi side of the plains. And if they did decide to strike at the war camps, the scouts and guards would give ample warning. So what is the point of the codes?
Adolin's father acted as if they were vitally important. Always be in uniform, always be armed, always stay sober. Be ever vigilant while under threat of attack.
But there is no threat of attack.
As he walked through the market, Adolin looked, really looked, for the first time, and tried to see what it was his father was doing. He could pick out Dalinar's officers easily. They wore their uniforms as commanded. Blue coats and trousers with silver buttons, knots on the shoulders for rank. Officers who weren't from Dalinar's camp wore all kinds of clothing. It was difficult to pick them out from the merchants and other wealthy civilians.
But that doesn't matter, because we're not going to be attacked.
He frowned, passing a group of light eyes lounging outside another wine house, much as he'd just been doing. Their clothing, indeed their postures and mannerisms, made them look like they cared only about their revelry.
There is a war going on. Almost every day, soldiers die. And they do so while light eyes drink and chat. Maybe the codes aren't just about protecting against the Parshendi. Maybe they're about something more. About giving the men commanders they can respect and rely on. About treating war with the gravity it deserves. Maybe it's about not turning a war zone into a festival.
The common men had to remain on watch, vigilant. Therefore, Adolin and Dalinar did the same. Adolin hesitated in the street. Nobody cursed at him or called for him to move. They could see his rank. They just went around him.
I think I see now. Why has it taken so long?
He hurried on his way toward the day's match.
I walked from Abamabar to Urthiru. In this, the metaphor and experience are one, inseparable to me like my mind and memory. One contains the other, and though I can explain one to you, the other is only for me.
Sadeus, sitting beside Dalinar, raised an eyebrow. Elikar sat on Dalinar's other side, wearing his shard plate. He'd taken to that more and more, sure that assassins were thirsting for his life. Together, they watched the men dueling down below, at the bottom of a small crater that Elikar had designated the war camp's dueling arena. The rocky shelves running around the inside of the 10-foot wall made excellent seating platforms. Adolin's duel hadn't started yet, and the men who fought right now were light eyes but not shard bearers. Their dull-edged dueling swords were crusted with a white, chalk-like substance. When one achieved a hit on the other's padded armor, it would leave a visible mark.
So, wait, this man...
Noadan is his holy name. Others call him Bajerdan, though we're not certain whether that was actually his real name or not.
He decided to walk from where to where?
Abamabar to Urthiru. and think it must have been a great distance from the way the story is told.
Wasn't he a king?
Yes.
But why?
It's confusing. But listen, you'll see. I strode this insightful distance on my own, and forbade attendance. I had no steed beyond my well-worn sandals, no companion beside a stout staff to offer conversation with its beats against the stone. My mouth was to be my purse. I stuffed it not with gems, but with song. When singing for sustenance failed me, my arms worked well for cleaning a floor or hog pen, and often earned me a satisfactory reward. Those dear to me took fright for my safety, and perhaps my sanity. Kings, they explained, do not walk like beggars for hundreds of miles. My response was that if a beggar could manage the feat, then why not a king? Did they think me less capable than a beggar? Sometimes I think that I am. The beggar knows much that the king can only guess. And yet who draws up the codes for begging ordinances? Often I wonder what my experience in life, my easy life following the desolation and my current level of comfort, has given me of any true experience to use in making laws. If we had to rely on what we knew, kings would only be of use in creating laws regarding the proper heating of tea and cushioning of thrones.
Sadius frowned at this. In front of them, the two swordsmen continued their duel. Elikar watched keenly. He loved duels. Bringing in sand to coat the floor of this arena had been one of his first acts at the Shattered Plains.
It goes on. Regardless, I made the trip and, as the astute reader has already concluded, survived it. The stories of its excitements will stain a different page in this narrative. For first, I must explain my purpose in walking this strange path. Though I was quite willing to let my family think me insane, I would not leave the same as my cognomen upon the winds of history. My family traveled to Urethiru via the direct method, and had been awaiting me for weeks when I arrived. I was not recognized at the gate, for my mane had grown quite robust without a razor to tame it. Once I revealed myself, I was carried away, primped, fed, worried over, and scolded in precisely that order. Only after all of this was through was I finally asked the purpose of my excursion. Couldn't I have just taken the simple, easy, and common route to the Holy City?
Exactly. He could at the very least have ridden a horse.
For my answer, I removed my sandals and proffered my calloused feet. They were comfortable upon the table beside my half-consumed tray of grapes. At this point, the expressions of my companions proclaimed that they thought me daft, and so I explained by relating the stories of my trip, one after another, like stacked sacks of talu stored for the winter season. I would make flatbread of them soon, then stuff it between these pages. Yes, I could have traveled quickly, but all men have the same ultimate destination. Whether we find our end in a hallowed sepulchre or a pauper's ditch, all save the heralds themselves must dine with the Night Watcher. And so, does the destination matter? Or is it the path we take? I declare that no accomplishment has substance nearly as great as the road used to achieve it. We are not creatures of destinations. It is the journey that shapes us. Our calloused feet, our backs strong from carrying the weight of our travels, our eyes open with the fresh delight of experiences lived. In the end, I must proclaim that no good can be achieved of false means. For the substance of our existence is not in the achievement, but in the method. The monarch must understand this. He must not become so focused on what he wishes to accomplish that he diverts his gaze from the path he must take to arrive there.
Dalinar sat back. The rock beneath them had been cushioned and augmented with wooden armrests and back supports. The duel ended with one of the Light Eyes, wearing green, as he was subject to Sadius, scoring a hit on the breastplate of the other, leaving a long white mark. Both duelists bowed. The winner's victory would be recorded by the women sitting in the judging seats. They also held the books of dueling code and would adjudicate disputes or infractions.
That is the end of your story, I presume.
It is.
And you have that entire passage memorized?
I likely got a few of the words wrong.
Knowing you, that means you might have forgotten a single an or the.
Dalinar frowned.
Oh, don't be so stiff, old friend. That was a compliment of sorts.
What did you think of the story?
It was ridiculous. He walked all that distance just to make the point that kings should consider the consequences of their commands.
It wasn't just to prove the point. I thought that myself, but I've begun to see. He walked because he wanted to experience the things his people did. He used it as a metaphor, but I think he really wanted to know what it was like to walk that far.
Sadius took a sip of his wine, then squinted up at the sun.
Oh, couldn't we get an awning or something set up out here?
I like the sun. I spent too much time locked away in those caves we call buildings.
Sadius studied Elikar, then glanced at Dalinar, rolling his eyes.
Much of the Way of Kings is organized like that passage I quoted you. A metaphor from Noadan's life, a real event turned into an example. He calls them the 40 Parables.
Are they all so ridiculous?
I think this one is beautiful.
I don't doubt that you do. You have always loved sentimental stories. That was also intended to be a compliment.
Of sorts.
Exactly. Dalinar, my friend, you have always been emotional. It makes you genuine. It can also get in the way of level-headed thinking, but so long as it continues to prompt you to save my life, I think I can live with it. I suppose, by definition, I would have to, wouldn't I?
I guess.
The other High Princess think you are self-righteous. Surely you can see why.
I don't mean to be.
Well, you do provoke them. Take, for example, the way you refuse to rise to their arguments or insults.
Protesting simply draws attention to the issue. The finest defense of character is correct action. Acquaint yourself with virtue, and you can expect proper treatment from those around you.
You see there? Who talks like that?
Dalinar does. My father used to.
Precisely, Dalinar, friend. The others simply cannot accept the things you say are serious. They assume it must be an act.
And you? What do you think of me?
I can see the truth.
Which is?
That you are a self-righteous prude. But you come by it honestly.
I'm certain you mean that to be a compliment, too.
Actually, this time I'm just trying to annoy you.
Sadius, that was quite nearly clever. Shall I have to name you the new wit?
What happened to the old one?
He vanished.
Is that so? How disappointing.
Ah, he does this on occasion. He'll return eventually. Unreliable as damnation itself, that one. If he didn't make me laugh so, I'd have him replaced seasons ago.
They fell silent, and the dueling continued. A few other light eyes, both women and men, watched, seated on the bench-like ridges. Dalinar noted with discomfort that Navani had arrived and was chatting with a group of women, including Adolin's latest infatuation, the auburn-haired scribe. Dalinar's eyes lingered on Navani, drinking in her violet dress, her mature beauty. She'd recorded his most recent visions without complaint and seemed to have forgiven him for throwing her out of his room so sharply. She never mocked him, never acted skeptical. He appreciated that.
Should I thank her, or will she see that as an invitation?
He averted his gaze from her, but found that he couldn't watch the dueling swordsman without catching sight of her in the corner of his eye. So, instead, he glanced up into the sky, squinting against the afternoon sun. Behind him, several large snails clung to the rock, waiting for high storm water. He had so many questions, so many uncertainties. He listened to the Way of Kings and worked to discover what Gavilar's last words had meant, as if somehow they held the key to both his madness and the nature of the visions. But the truth was that he didn't know anything, and he couldn't rely on his own decisions. That was unhinging him, bit by bit, point by point. Clouds seemed less frequent here in these wind-swept plains, just the blazing sun broken by the furious high storms. The rest of Roshar was influenced by the storms, but here, in the east, the feral, untamed high storms ruled supreme. Could any mortal king hope to claim these lands? There were legends of them being inhabited, of there being more than just unclaimed hills, desolate plains, and overgrown forests. Natinatin, the Granite Kingdom.
Ah, did he have to come?
Dalinar lowered his head and followed Sadius's gaze. High Prince Vama had arrived to watch the dueling. retinue in tow. Though most of them wore his traditional brown and gray colorings, the High Prince himself wore a long gray coat that had slashes cut across it to reveal the bright red and orange silk underneath, matched by the ruffles peeking out of the cuffs and collar.
I thought you had a fondness for Vama.
I tolerate him, but his fashion sense is absolutely repulsive. Red and orange? Not even a burnt orange, but a blatant, eye-breaking orange. And the red style hasn't been fashionable for ages. Oh, wonderful. He's sitting directly across from us. I shall be forced to stare at him for the rest of the session.
You shouldn't judge people so harshly based on how they look.
Dalinar, we are high princes. We represent Alethkar. Many around the world view us as a center of culture and influence. Should I not, therefore, have the right to encourage a proper presentation to the world?
A proper presentation, yes. It is right for us to be fit and neat. It would be nice if your soldiers, for instance, kept their uniforms clean.
Fit, neat, and fashionable.
And me? Would you have me dress in those ruffles and bright colors?
You? You're completely hopeless. No, I am unfair. That uniform has a certain timeless quality to it. The military suit, by virtue of its utility, will never be completely out of fashion. It's a safe choice. Steady. In a way, you avoid the issue of fashion by not playing the game. Vama tries to play, but does so very poorly, and that is unforgivable.
I still say you place too much importance on those silks and scarves. We are soldiers at war, not courtiers at a ball.
The Shattered Plains are quickly becoming a destination for foreign dignitaries. It is important to present ourselves properly. If I am to accept your moral superiority, my friend, then perhaps it is time for you to accept my sense of fashion. One might note that you judge people by their clothing even more than I do.
Dalinar fell silent. That comment stung in its truthfulness. Still, if dignitaries were going to meet with the High Princes on the Shattered Plains, was it too much to ask for them to find an efficient group of war camps led by men who at least looked like generals? Dalinar settled back to watch the match end. By his count, it was time for Adolin's bout. The two light eyes who had been fighting bowed to the king, then withdrew into a tent on the side of the dueling grounds. A moment later, Adolin stepped out onto the sand wearing his deep blue shard plate. He carried his helm under his arm, his blonde and black hair a stylish mess. He raised a gauntleted hand to Dalinar and bowed his head to the king, then put on his helm. The man who walked out behind him wore shardplate painted yellow. Bright Lord Ressi was the only full shardbearer in High Prince Thanatol's army, though their war camp had three men who carried only the blade or the plate. Thanatol himself had neither. It wasn't uncommon for a high prince to rely on his finest warriors as shard bearers. It made sound sense, particularly if you were the sort of general who preferred to stay behind the lines and direct tactics. In Thanadol's own princedom, the tradition for centuries had been to appoint the holder of Ressi's shards as something known as the Royal Defender. Thanadol had recently been vocal about Dalinar's faults, and so Adolin, in a moderately subtle move, had challenged the High Prince's star shardbearer to a friendly bout. Few duels were for shards. In this case, losing wouldn't cost either man anything other than statistics in the rankings. The match drew an unusual amount of attention, and the small arena filled over the next quarter hour while duelists stretched and prepared. More than one woman set up a board to sketch or write impressions of the bout. Thanadol himself didn't attend. The bout began. Ressi stood in stone stance, his shard blade held before him in two hands, point toward the sky, arms all the way extended. Adolin used wind stance, turned sideways slightly, hands before him and elbows bent, shard blade pointing back over his head. They circled. The winner would be the first one who completely shattered a section of the other's shard plate. That wasn't too dangerous. Weakened plate could usually still rebuff a blow, even if it shattered in the process. Ressi attacked first, taking a hopping leap forward and striking by whipping his shard blade back over his head, then down to his right in a powerful blow. Adolin jumped back out of the way, shard plate enhanced legs, giving him a nimbleness that defied the fact that he was wearing over 100 stone weights of thick armor. Russi's attack, though well executed, left him open, and Adolin made a careful strike at his opponent's left bambrace, cracking the forearm plate. Russi attacked again, and Adolin again danced out of the way, then scored a hit on his opponent's left thigh. Some poets described combat as a dance. Dalinar rarely felt that way about regular combat. Two men fighting with sword and shield would go at one another in a furious rush, slamming their weapons down again and again, trying to get around their opponent's shield. Less a dance and more like wrestling with weapons. Fighting with shard blades, though, that could be like a dance. The large weapons took a great deal of skill to swing properly, and plate was resilient, so exchanges were generally drawn out. The fights were filled with grand motions, wide sweeps. There was a fluidity to fighting with a shard blade, a grace.
He's quite good, you know.
Adolin made a hit on Russi's helm.
Better than my father was. Better than even you, Uncle.
He works very hard. He truly loves it. Not the war, not the fighting, the dueling.
He could be champion, if he wished it.
Adolin did wish it, Dalinar knew. But he had refused bouts that would put him within reach of the title. Dalinar suspected that Adolin did it to hold somewhat to the codes. Dueling championships and tournaments were things for those rare times between wars. It could be argued that protecting one's family honor, however, was for all times. Either way, Adolin didn't duel for ranking, and that made other shard bearers underestimate him. They were quick to accept duels with him, and some non-shard bearers challenged him. By tradition, the king's own shard plate and blade were available for a large fee to those who both had his favor and the wish to duel a shard bearer. Dalinar shivered at the thought of someone else wearing his plate or holding Oathbringer. It was unnatural. And yet, the lending of the king's blade and plate, or, before the kingship had been restored, the lending of a high prince's blade and plate, was a strong tradition. Even Gavilar had not broken it, though he had complained about it in private. Adolin dodged another blow, but he had begun to move into Windstance's offensive forms. Resi wasn't ready for this. Though he managed to hit Adolin once on the right pauldron, the blow was a glancing one. Adolin advanced, blade sweeping in a fluid pattern. Resi backed away, falling into a parrying posture. Stone Stance was one of the few to rely on those. Adolin batted his opponent's blade away, knocking it out of stance. Resi reset, but Adolin knocked it away again. Resi grew sloppier and sloppier, getting back into stance, and Adolin began to strike, hitting him on one side, then on the other. Small, quick blows meant to a nerve. They worked. Resi threw himself into one of Stone Stance's characteristic overhand blows. Adolin handled it perfectly, dropping his blade to one hand, raising his left arm, and taking the blow on his unharmed vambrace. It cracked badly, but the move allowed Adolin to bring his own blade to the side and strike Resi's cracked left quiss. The thigh plate shattered, pieces blasting away, trailing smoke, glowing like molten steel. Resi stumbled back. His left leg could no longer bear the weight of the shard plate. The match was over. More important duels might go for two or three broken plates, but that grew dangerous. Resi stumbled away, ripping off his helm. Adolin saluted his enemy, tapping the blunt edge of his blade to his forehead, then dismissing the blade. He bowed to the king. Other men sometimes went into the crowd to brag or accept accolades, but Adolin retreated to the preparation tent.
Talented indeed.
And such a proper lad.
Yes. At times I wish there were peace, simply so that Adolin could dedicate himself to his dueling.
More talk of abandoning the war, Dalinar.
That's not what I meant.
You keep complaining that you've given up the argument, Uncle. Yet you continue to dance around it, speaking longingly of peace. People in the camps call you coward.
He's no coward, Your Majesty. I can attest to that.
Why, then?
These rumors have grown far beyond what is reasonable.
And yet you do not answer my questions. If you could make the decision, Uncle, would you have us leave the Shattered Plains? Are you a coward?
Dalinar hesitated.
Unite them. It is your task, and I give it to you.
Am I a coward? Noadan challenged him in the book to examine himself. To never become so certain or high that he wasn't willing to seek truth.
Elakar's question hadn't been about his visions, and yet Dalinar had the distinct impression that he was being a coward, at least in his relation to his desire to abdicate. If he left because of what was happening to him, that would be taking the easy path.
I can't leave. No matter what happens, I have to see this through, even if I am mad.
Or, an increasingly worrisome thought, even if the visions were real, but their origins suspect.
I have to stay, but I also have to plan, to make sure I don't tow my house down. Such a careful line to walk. Nothing clear, everything clouded.
He'd been ready to run because he liked to make clear decisions. Well, nothing was clear about what was happening to him. It seemed that in making the decision to remain High Prince, he placed one important cornerstone into rebuilding the foundation of who he was. He would not abdicate, and that was that.
Dalinar, are you well?
Dalinar blinked, realizing that he had stopped paying attention to the king and Sadeus. Staring off into space like that wouldn't help his reputation.
You want to know the truth? Yes. If I could make the order, I would bring all 10 war camps and return to Alethkar.
Despite what others said, that was not cowardly. No, he'd just confronted cowardice inside of him, and he knew what it was.
This is something different.
The king looked shocked.
I would leave, but not because I wish to flee or because I fear battle. It would be because I fear for Alethkar's stability. Leaving this war would help secure our homeland and the loyalty of the High Princes. I would send more envoys and scholars to find out why the Parshendi killed Gavilar. We gave up too easily on that. I still wonder if the assassination was initiated by miscreants or rebels among their own people. I'd discover what their culture is, and yes, they do have one. If rebels weren't the cause of the assassination, I'd keep asking until I learned why they did it. I'd demand repayment, perhaps their own king delivered to us for execution in turn, in exchange for granting them peace. As for the Gemhearts, I'd speak with my scientists and discover a better method of holding this territory. Perhaps with mass homesteading of the area, securing all of the unclaimed hills, we could truly expand our borders and claim the Shattered Plains. I wouldn't abandon vengeance, Your Majesty, but I would approach it and our war here more thoughtfully. Right now, we know too little to be effective.
Uncle, that actually makes sense. Why didn't you explain it before?
Dalinar blinked. Just several weeks ago, Elakar had been indignant when Dalinar had merely mentioned the idea of turning back. What had changed?
I don't give the boy enough credit.
I have had trouble explaining my own thoughts recently, Your Majesty.
Your Majesty! Surely you wouldn't actually consider...
This latest attempt on my life has me unsettled, Satius. Tell me, have you made any progress in determining who put the weakened gems in my plate?
Not yet, Your Majesty.
They're trying to kill me. They'll see me dead, like my father. Sometimes I do wonder if we're chasing after the 10 fools here. The assassin in white, he was Shin.
The Parshendi took responsibility for sending him.
Yes, and yet they are savages and easily manipulated. It would be a perfect distraction, pinning the blame on a group of Parshmen. We go to war for years and years, never noticing the real villains, working quietly in my own camp. They watch me, always, waiting. I see their faces in mirrors, symbols, twisted, inhuman.
Dalinar glanced at Sadeus, and the two shared a disturbed look. Was Elakar's paranoia growing worse, or had it always been hidden? He saw phantom cabals in every shadow, and now, with the attempt on his life, he had proof to feed those worries.
Retreating from the Shattered Plains could be a good idea, but not if it is to begin another war with someone else. We must stabilize and unify our people.
Chasing the assassin is only an idle thought right now. Perhaps we won't need it. I hear that your efforts with Dalinar have been fruitful.
They have indeed, Your Majesty. Though he still insists on using his own slow bridges. Sometimes my forces are nearly wiped out before he arrives. This would work better if Dalinar would use modern bridge tactics.
The waste of life
is acceptable. They're mostly slaves, Dalinar. It's an honor for them to have a chance to participate in some small way.
I doubt they see it in that light.
I wish you'd at least try my way. What we've been doing so far has worked, but I worry that the Parshendi will continue to send two armies against us. I don't relish the idea of fighting both on my own before you arrive.
Dalinar hesitated. That would be a problem.
But give up the siege bridges?
Well, why not a compromise? Next plateau assault. Uncle, you let Sadius's bridge men help you for the initial march to the contested plateau. Sadius has plenty of extra bridge crews he could lend you. He could still rush on ahead with a smaller army, but you'd follow more quickly than you have been using his bridge crews.
That would be the same as using my own bridge crews.
Not necessarily. You've said that the Parshendi can rarely set up and fire on you once Sadius engages them. Sadius's men can start the assault as usual, and you can join once he's secured a foothold for you.
Yes, the bridgemen you use will be safe, and you won't be costing any additional lives. But you'll arrive at the plateau to help me twice as quickly.
What if you can't distract the Parshendi well enough? What if they still set up archers to fire on my bridgemen when I cross?
Then we'll retreat, and we'll call it a failed experiment, but at least we'll have tried. This is how you get ahead, old friend. You try new things.
Dalinar scratched his chin and thought.
Oh, go on, Dalinar. He took your suggestion to attack together. Try it once his way.
Very well. We will see how it works.
Excellent. And now I believe I'll go congratulate your son. That bout was exciting.
Dalinar hadn't found it particularly exciting. Adolin's opponent hadn't ever held the upper hand. But that was the best kind of battle. Dalinar didn't buy the arguments about a good fight being a close one. When you won, it was always better to win quickly and with extreme advantage. Dalinar and Sadius stood in respect as the king descended the stair-like stone outcroppings toward the sandy floor below. Dalinar then turned to Sadius.
I should be leaving. Send me a clerk to detail the plateaus you feel we could try this maneuver on. Next time one of them is up for an assault, I'll march my army to your staging area and we'll leave together. You and the smaller, quicker group can go on ahead, and we'll catch up once you're in position.
Sadius nodded. Dalinar turned to climb up the steps toward the ramp out.
Dalinar!
Dalinar looked back at the other High Prince. Sadius's scarf fluttered in a gust of wind, his arms folded, the metallic golden embroidery glistening.
Send me one of your clerks as well, with a copy of that book of Gavilar's. It may amuse me to hear its other stories.
I will do so, Sadius.